The competitiveness of Alaska LNG does not rank well when compared to other peer jurisdictions that could supply North Asia.
Bleak news for the current gas line project. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the potential impact of a smaller PFD on local sales tax revenue.
It could have a ripple effect of just overall reduction in spending, and it that exceeds the pure loss of dollars.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Alaska's natural gas pipeline project, as currently envisioned, is not competitive and likely cannot succeed in the current market. That's the conclusion of a report from the outside consulting firm Wood Mackenzie. But the report says major changes, similar to those being proposed by Governor Bill Walker's administration, could make the project more viable. Under the current model, Alaska is partnering with the three major North Slope producers, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, to build the pipeline. Wood Mackenzie's David Barrowman told lawmakers this afternoon that his firm compared that model to other natural gas projects around the world.
The competitiveness of Alaska LNG does not rank well when compared to other peer jurisdictions that could supply, or peer projects that could supply, North Asia. The ranking means that under current pricing assumptions, it would certainly struggle. And even if prices, oil prices, rose to around about $70 a barrel, then it would be difficult to make acceptable returns.
But Barrowman said there are ways to lower the project's cost. One option is bringing in outside investors to fund the gas line instead of the partners funding it themselves. Another path is full state ownership, which might lower federal taxes. Those are both options the state is considering as it seeks to take control of the gas line project, according to Keith Meyer, the new head of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Meyer and Barrowman testified today at a joint hearing of the House and Senate Natural Resources Committee. The hearing will continue tomorrow with testimony from the state's three current partners, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. Only three votes now separate two Northern Alaska House candidates. Dean Westlake of Kotzebue has 780 votes ahead of 777 votes for incumbent Representative Benjamin Nagiak, who's from Barrow. Alaska's Division of Elections is still counting votes from House District 40, which stretches from Kotzebue to Koktovik. Elections Director Josie Banke says a review board met in Nome yesterday and certified 42 ballots in the race, but there are still more to count.
You know, I've kind of been talking to staff about this being a marathon, not a sprint.
Banke's division has come under fire in recent days for voting irregularities in the northwest Arctic village of Shungnak. Voters there were given ballots for both primaries. They were only supposed to get one. Banke says her division is working with the Department of Law to determine what to do if the added ballots in Shungnak appear to change the outcome of the race. Banke says there are at least 120 ballots left to count for House District 40. Those include question, special needs, and absentee ballots. The state deadline to count absentee ballots is Friday. The election should be certified by September 2nd. Local governments in Alaska that charge a sales tax could have millions of dollars less in revenue this year. That's because their residents will have less money to spend than the last few years due to lower permanent fund dividends this fall. Some municipalities, like the city and borough of Juneau, are preparing for the indirect hit. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports.
City and Borough of Juneau Finance Director Bob Bartholomew projects Governor Bill Walker's veto of about half of dividend funds will cost the city.
We had estimated that the reduction of the dividend from $2,000 per person to $1,000 per person would cost us, you know, at the high end, about $1 million of lost sales tax revenue.
That's out of $44 million of total sales tax revenue that the city projected. Juneau is one of 107 municipalities in the state that collect sales taxes. These communities raised a total of $233 million in sales tax revenue 2 years ago. So, if we apply Bartholomew's projections to the entire state, there would be $4 million to $5 million less coming in. Bartholomew says it's challenging to estimate how much less residents will spend. In part, that's because having less money to spend could lead residents' behavior to change.
It could have a ripple effect of just overall reduction in spending, and that exceeds the pure loss of dollars just because of the overall just psychological impact on spending.
Walker has said the dividend reduction was necessary in order to shore up the state's finances in the long run. Without the cut, Walker says PFDs could disappear entirely in 2 years as the state exhausts permanent fund earnings. Each municipality is handling the sales tax effect in its own way. Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Mike Navarre says the borough has never analyzed how residents spend their dividends. The borough based its projection for sales tax revenue on last year's spending and hasn't made adjustments based on the veto.
Sometimes it's difficult to predict exactly what the impacts are going to be. In this case, we have proximity to Anchorage, so some people will buy bigger items in Anchorage because they don't have sales tax or because they're going up there to shop anyway.
Navarre has a separate concern about how the PFD cut will affect tax revenue. The borough set its property tax due date to occur after residents receive dividend checks. Navarre says borough officials will be keeping a close eye on whether residents will struggle to pay their taxes on time if they have less money due to the lower dividends. Other municipalities are taking a wait-and-see approach to falling sales tax revenue. In Unalaska, City Manager Dave Martinson says he has looked at the issue, but decided against lowering the city's revenue estimates.
So we're going to take an approach that says we will watch it as we go through the year to determine whether or not there is something that we would need to take to our council.
Municipal governments were affected by other changes Walker made in his late June vetoes. He also cut state payments for school debt, transportation, and other funding. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Crews are beginning work to quell the rapid advance of the Matanuska River in the community of Butte. Matanuska Susitna Borough Public Information Officer Patty Sullivan says work began yesterday.
They felled all the giant cottonwoods. The trees are all down in a stretch there. And the plan is that they're going to dig a trench, between the river and the power line.
The trench will be up to about 20 feet deep and 525 feet long. In the trench, Sullivan says, crews will install a wall of armor rock to help shore up the embankment and protect it from the Matanuska River.
400 to 800 pound rocks, they're angular, they can be sort of keyed together and won't move easily when pressure is applied. And it could, you know, the intent is to deflect any water that might be pounding against it.
Sullivan says there is a $1 million cap on funds from the state for construction. More money would require legislative approval. While the borough and state have declared a disaster as the Matanuska River edges closer to the community, Sullivan says a breach of the embankment currently does not appear imminent. Sullivan says at the narrowest point, about 120 feet of land separates the river from the road. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, paratrooper training at J-Bear.
You know, there's a lot of long days in the office. You know, jumping from an aircraft in flight makes up for all of that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees for the unconventional student or working professional who wants learning on their schedule and timeline. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Hundreds of parachutes dotted the sky near Anchorage yesterday afternoon as more than 450 Airborne Army paratroopers participated in a joint forcible entry exercise at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, or JBEAR. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early went to the drop zone to see the exercise firsthand.
Hurtling toward Earth at 18 feet per second might not sound appealing to a lot of people, but paratroopers live for it.
There's a lot of long days in the office, especially when you're somebody like me who works on a brigade staff. Jumping from an aircraft in flight makes up for all of that.
Major Adam Hallmark is a public affairs official and an experienced paratrooper.
The adrenaline rush, the thoughts that are racing through your mind is, when those doors raise inside the aircraft and you feel that rush of wind come inside the cabin and it's about time to step outside that door. It's unexplainable, really.
Soldiers landing in the drop zone around us aren't simply jumping and landing. They then must pack up their parachute, grab all of their gear, including a rucksack and a weapon, and proceed to a drop-off point. Battalion Commander Lieutenant Colonel James Updegraft says frequent training keeps soldiers battle ready.
Usually two to three per year is what we try to get to. This is our bread and butter. This is what we bring to the fight. It's a big deal when we do it. It's a lot of planning and synchronization goes into it. So
by a lot of planning, Updegraft means about 90 days of preparation and synchronization for one jump. Safety is a top priority for the exercise. One trooper who landed nearby got an earful from his superior for not moving fast enough to stow his gear.
And they don't suck them up into everything, huh?
Yes, Sergeant.
All right, get your weapon into operation, get your f***ing silk put away, then derig your ruck.
Lieutenant Colonel Updegraft says soldiers carry a lot of weight on their jumps.
Parachute now, the new T-11 is 35 pounds. I'm spitballing that, but 35 pounds, and then the equipment like that I had hanging down between my legs was a 60-pound rucksack. So we plan on jumpers exiting at 350 pounds, including your body weight and then all the equipment.
Even as a seasoned jumper, Hallmark looks at the troopers in awe, knowing himself the feeling of falling from the sky.
For a brief moment, it's all is right in the world and you're just kind of up there doing your thing, and then it's back down to reality, literally.
Hallmark says a lot of time, effort, and resources are dedicated to practice for combat drops.
Because being a paratrooper is a perishable skill. If you don't practice it, you'll forget the things that you've been taught. So we have to do this on a continual basis in order to maintain our proficiency.
Alaska is just one training area for these paratroopers. Next year, Hallmark says there are plans for jumps in Australia, Indonesia, and Japan. Reporting at Fort Richardson, I'm Wesley Early.
While trawling the floor of the Bering Sea and the Aleutian region, scientists have discovered several new species of fish, snailfish. Some were only named last year. Researchers were not looking for them. The trawl was part of a yearly stock assessment by the federal government that helped set quotas for fisheries. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has more from Unalaska.
Snailfish look like overweight tadpoles. They don't have scales, making them easy to damage. Biologist Jay Orr of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association says that partly explains why there are so many unnamed species.
When they come up in trawls that we use to sample the bottom and do our assessment surveys, they are tossed about in the nets and pretty well torn up by the time they get to the deck where we do our sorting work.
But really, the different species are just hard to distinguish. Orr thinks scientists might have avoided identifying them and called all snailfish, snailfish. Now with a special bag attached to the trawl, it's easier to collect the fish undamaged.
I was able to see them alive and in good shape and in full color, and began to realize that we were seeing different species, and I could begin to realize that we hadn't seen these species before.
From the Arctic to Antarctica, there are more than 350 different types of snailfish that live in a variety of environments, from shallow tide pools to the depths of the Marianas Trench. That's more than 4 miles beneath the ocean's surface, making snailfish the deepest known swimmers in the vertebrate world. Orr says a lot is still unknown, but it's important to study snailfish to improve our inventory of the ocean environment.
To understand the biodiversity system is to understand, you know, how many species are actually out there. And we can't really begin to manage the ecosystem until we understand what pieces are there.
With 86 species of snailfish known to live in Alaska so far, it's a complex picture for scientists to piece together. But Orr is up to the task. Over his career, he's discovered 26 different species of snailfish. About a dozen of those still need names. And now, he's starting work on a new project, identifying the evolutionary relationships of North Pacific snailfish and piecing together their place in the global snailfish family. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Southeast Alaska's largest tribal organization says this month's meetings with the U.S. State Department and Environmental Protection Agency were productive. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The 30,000-member Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska set up the government-to-government meetings. President Richard Peterson says representatives heard about potential and existing pollution from British Columbia mines near rivers that flow into Alaska.
I think we gave them some of our concerns and questions and whatnot. That gives them the chance to kind of go back and now have that next conversation that's a little more action-based and promissory in nature.
The federal officials met with tribal government and Native corporation leaders from Juneau, Ketchikan, Saxman, Douglas, and Kassan during the August 9th through 11th meetings. Peterson says they talked about water quality monitoring along fish and wildlife-rich transboundary rivers. He says the federal officials expressed interest in supporting the effort.
And we were able to use that as an opportunity to push for more funding for activities region-wide so that other communities can do that baseline analysis that needs to take place.
State Department and EPA public affairs staff offered no comment on the meetings or any commitments made, but Peterson says they agreed to hold further meetings, which will happen this fall in Washington, D.C. Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott and other state officials presented their concerns at the meetings. He says they brought up a U.S.-Canada Boundary Waters Treaty that includes a commission tasked with resolving such conflicts.
We emphasize that if, when, how, in what manner that the IJC, the International Joint Commission, might be engaged, that we would be, number one, welcome it, number two, be part of it to the degree that that was appropriate.
Malott heads up a state task force on transboundary mine concerns. He says his team also brought up the need for more federal support.
To put it mildly, Alaska is resource constrained, at least fiscal resource constrained right now. And these collaborations and network building is very important.
Alaska and British Columbia officials have been discussing the state's concerns for more than a year. A statement of cooperation detailing ways Alaska can provide more input into mine decisions is nearing a final draft. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
A citizen petition to ask voters whether commercial marijuana operations should be banned outside city limits in the Kenai Peninsula borough is now in the hands of the borough assembly. The petition has received sufficient signatures to be certified. Now the assembly has two options. They can do nothing, and the issue will be on the fall 2017 ballot, or they can hold a special election. That would have to be done by ordinance, which allows for public hearing at the assembly. Borough officials estimate that a special election would cost around $60,000, whether it is conducted by mail or by voting stations.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Around the world, twice a day, every day, more than 700 weather balloons launch into the air. 14 of those balloons are released across Alaska, tracking things like temperature, humidity, and wind speed. They provide a wealth of information for people like Brian Brettschneider, a climatologist in Anchorage. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with him regularly as part of a new segment, Ask a Climatologist. This week, Brettschneider is responding to a question from a listener named Dennis, who asked why surface winds can sometimes be traveling in the opposite direction of winds several thousand feet up. Brettschneider told Energy Desk editor Annie Feit, weather balloons highlight that phenomenon every day.
The listener is correct that they can very often be come from different directions. So just I looked at the weather balloon reports from yesterday from Anchorage, and there was winds at the surface were coming from the southeast, and at several thousand, 5,000, 10,000 feet up, coming from the northeast. And there's a couple of good reasons for that. It's actually much more pronounced in the wintertime, but the conditions that drive the winds at the upper levels can be, in many cases, quite a bit different than what's going on at the surface.
And weather balloons are the best way to capture these differences?
Yeah, and so the weather balloon program has gone on since 1948, and it's it's an important snapshot in time. So, yeah, the weather balloon, it's the gold standard for those kind of wind observations.
And we have a lot of them in Alaska.
Right. We have 14, and they ring the coastline, and there's a couple of the interior, and they launch twice per day at the exact same time. About 750 to 800 stations globally, they all release their balloons at the exact same time. So it's very important to have that snapshot in time of what's going on in the atmosphere.
And as a climatologist, how much attention do you pay to what's happening with these weather balloons?
Well, I think it's fascinating. You know, from an operational point of view, the meteorologists, the forecasters at the National Weather Service and other places, they pay very close attention to how the weather balloon data looks on each of these twice daily. From a climatology point of view, it's also very important. So I was able to look at them historically and look at, say, the amount of moisture in the atmosphere or the temperatures at 5,000 feet and other levels. And, you know, again, sometimes what goes on at the surface kind of masks what the general state of the atmosphere is. And we see that particularly in winter. We can have a very warm air mass at 5 and 10 and 15,000 feet, but we have a little bubble of cold air stuck over us at the surface. So in reality, it's a warm air mass, but we don't even know it. And without that weather balloon, we would have no idea.
Okay, and what happens to the balloons?
Well, after with the low pressure at tens of thousands of feet up, the balloon pops, and it's got a little parachute, and it slowly makes its way back down to the earth. And it has some instructions on it for if anyone finds it, how to return it. They can be refurbished. Here in Alaska, almost none are ever found, in part because most of our stations are along the coast, and there's a high probability that they fall in the water. Now, a friend of mine actually did find one this summer in the Chugach Mountains in a very isolated spot. And that was kind of an uncommon event. I believe somewhere less than 1% of the balloons launched in Alaska are ever found. But they're a very important piece of the climatological puzzle for Alaska.
Brian Brettschneider is an Anchorage-based climatologist. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. Do you have a climate question for Brian? Email akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. There's a lot of former Midwesterners in Alaska. I'm among them. And if you lived in Minnesota or Wisconsin in the 1970s and got your news from KSTP in Minneapolis, then Barry Zavan, the weatherman, was a celebrity you knew. Celebrity might seem like a weird way to describe a guy who told you whether you'd need an umbrella or sunscreen, but his mix of theatrics and famous guests made him a household name. He spent time in Alaska serving in the Air Force at Elmendorf in 1955 and covered the Iditarod for ESPN in the 80s. He's written a book, and his Alaska adventures are part of an incredible career. He used his quirky mix of meteorology and movie stars when he auditioned for a job at KSTP.
I decided to send the goofiest tape I could find. Red Fox and Juliet Prowse were guests on my weather show on this particular tape. Anyway, I sent that, and one where I was throwing a pie in the face of the sportscaster. A week and a half later, I got a call from KSTP-TV, the then NBC affiliate, now ABC, and said, we want to talk to you. So that's literally how I wound up here.
Let's talk for a moment, Mr. Zevan, about your Alaska connections. You know or knew two of Alaska's former governors, Wally Hickel and Tony Knowles. Tell us about how you knew these folks.
Well, Wally I met in D.C. when I was on the air in Washington, D.C., and he had been with the Nixon administration, and just got to know him through him being in the studio. And he was a terrific personality, and as every Alaskan knows, he was one heck of a governor, in my opinion, just full of personality himself. But Tony Knowles, one of the fun stories, actually I think it's in the book, is I was sent by Channel 11 here, for whom I work. Anyway, they sent me up to cover the beginning of the Iditarod, not only for them, but for ESPN. So whatever year that would have been, 84, 85. I had remembered after my Elmendorf days that you got 10 minutes of daylight every day from December 22nd on. But that particular year, there was almost no snow in Anchorage on 4th Avenue. And Tony Knowles, then mayor of Anchorage, made fun with me. And he said, you know, Barry, he said, it's 40 degrees warmer here than it is in Minneapolis today.
Your book is out now, Barry Zevan, My Life Among the Giants, a memoir. What do you want people to take away from it in reading your story?
Well, what they see in maybe a personality they see on television all the time, there's a lot more to their lives than just what they see. And this particular life has been too much. I was going to entitle the book Too Much Life because it has touched every base. As one person said, you've done everything except being arrested and going to jail. And that's true. Those are the only two things probably I've ever had happen to me in my life.
Barry Zevan's book, My Life Among the Giants, about his celebrity weatherman career, is available now. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz, Annie Fite, Josh Edge, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Dacia Eaton in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story. It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The 2016 Alaska State Fair will be completely smoke-free, protecting all fairgoers from exposure to tobacco smoke and the aerosol from electronic smoking devices. If you use tobacco or e-cigarettes, now is a great time to connect with Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line for free support, to set a quit date, and then breathe easy at the Alaska State Fair. Call 1-800-QUIT now or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.